I'm Christopher Lydon with the global economist Jeffrey Sachs, who's been making house calls on countries for 25 years now to cure hyperinflation in Bolivia, to give Poland and Russia cold showers coming out of communism, to fight malaria and press development in Africa. On this round, the country that gives him the chills is his and ours, the USA. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one with the economist I always picture as an old-fashioned doctor with little black bag and stethoscope taking the pulse of growth in China, hunger in the third world. Jeffrey Sachs leads the Earth Institute at Columbia University. His new book, The Price of Civilization, is about us, the home base, which, as he says, he thought for most of his life he didn't have to worry about. Jeff Sachs, you've been eminent in this profession for almost 40 years, and in what now feels like a kind of slide toward a precipice. I want to get your sort of human history of what happened. I mean, you emerged in, say, early Reagan, before the internet, really, before globalization was a household word, before the digitization of industry, before we discovered China, in a sense, as a major player. So much promise, still huge promise in a way, but what the hell happened?
Well, I would start for myself even earlier, of course, which is the formative experience as a young person and thinking about the world was the decade of going to the moon. And I remember, of course, sitting by the radio for the early morning flights from Cape Canaveral of the early Mercury flights, or, of course, watching, as the whole world did on television, as Neil Armstrong stepped foot on the moon.
And you mean 69, 70?
In 69. And for me, that was not just a wondrous achievement, but it was the sense of the country we were living in. So I had a feeling as a young American in the Midwest that this was a country that really could do anything, where a president could say at the beginning of the decade, we're going to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of the decade, and gosh darn it, we do it. This was a country that could fight a war on poverty. This is a country that could launch the Environmental Protection Agency, even under Richard Nixon. It was a country where one felt one would see great things be tried and championed and accomplished. I think I've never personally lost the tingle of John Kennedy's speeches. Mm-hmm. For me, they were life-defining. And the idea that together as a country we could do great things, and the overriding sense of bewilderment that I have in writing this book is that we've come to seem like a country that has lost two vital things. One is a sense of society itself. We are individuals, it seems, where people cheer in Republican presidential debates at the unemployed or at attacking the unemployed, or that sense of purpose as a society, I feel, is hanging by a thread right now. And second, we have a real sense where we are daring not to try anything, at least not to try anything through politics. There still are the accomplishments of a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or others, and those are very real. They're world-changing. They're very important. But they're not all that there is to a society. A society also takes on great challenges together. And however one feels about the war on poverty, and I feel that it was one of America's greatest moments and actually one that delivered a lot of success, I think the mere fact of a society taking that on is also a measure of greatness. And that's almost completely gone now. And that's the shocking thing that I have been trying to understand gradually as I've seen it over a period of many, many years, to the point where this summer I had, I think, 22 country stops abroad, as I typically am visiting a number of countries in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America and in Africa, I didn't hear one statement of U.S. global leadership all summer in meetings of great importance for the world, in meetings dealing with horrendous humanitarian crises or major geopolitical challenges or economic events that are shaking the world. We are not present in the way we used to be. People inside the country might not feel it the same way I do, because when I started in economics, not only did I have a feeling of being part of a wonderful society that would solve problems and take on big challenges, but I also felt that force at my back, wind in the sails whenever I was abroad, that I counted on the U.S. to help play a constructive role in the world. And I've seen that shrink now over a 20-year period to a point where it almost isn't present at all. Of course, we're engaged in these wars, but we're not engaged in global building right now, in constructive approaches to many key problems. So I've seen a change that is absolutely remarkable.
That absence is a shocker, Jeff. I was in one country last summer, Pakistan, where we're at war. And yet there's a terrific silence of kind of the American voice and a complete unrealism, I think, in what we're up to, what we've always been up to there, and what we'll be up to there probably for a long time. I wonder who is present at those meetings you go to. Is China there? Is France there? Is Britain there?
In general, Europe is publicly raising its voice. India and Brazil, much more. China is powerfully there, but generally behind the scenes. Chinese senior officials are doing things that are running circles around American economic diplomacy. Wherever you go in Africa right now, it's the Chinese that are building the power plants, the roads, the factories. It's not just that both the U.S. and China are not publicly speaking. We're not publicly speaking, but even behind the scenes, we're not doing anything except sending drone missiles or thinking about security.
Well, that's exactly the picture in Pakistan.
Our foreign policy has come down to basically Pentagon-led initiatives by people who don't really have much of a view about the world but know a lot about drone missiles. And it's never going to get us anywhere. And we are living through a period that is like the one that Charles Kindleberger, the late MIT economic historian, famously described about the 1930s. He said it was an interregnum. The British Empire had already declined, but the American empire or leadership had not yet come to recognize its responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So after the 1929 financial crisis started, there was no leadership anywhere. And he said that it was that absence of leadership that allowed the world economy to unravel. We're in a period like that right now, where the U.S. did lead for many decades. The withdrawal from U.S. leadership has been going on in a lot of ways for the last 20 to 25 years, but it's become precipitous in the last few years. And I feel that we're trapped in a spin cycle, and we're not going to address deep challenges. Boy, this country could not put a man on the moon and bring him back to Earth in a decade the way we go right now, because we'd have to do it by the next election. We'd have to have a surge to the moon and back. We'd have to have some gimmickry where we would do something that's shovel-ready, a shovel-ready trip to the moon. A jolt, a stimulus, a surge. It's all about the short term. It's so relentlessly about the short term that nobody's thinking longer. And anytime a candidate does, he's told a couple of things. One is, you can't do that because you won't be here after the next election if you behave that way. And second, here's the long list of your campaign donors, and they're not going to be too happy if you say that.
Jeff Sachs, I love the picture of the economist who makes country calls, the doctor who makes house calls, and looks at the whole patient, in a sense. whether it's a UN Millennium Project in East Africa or China or India, make a house call with us. Why isn't this patient responding, even to a classic sort of American challenge from China?
This patient already started to feel bad in the 1970s. That was a pretty unhappy period. We had fever back then. We had instability, high inflation, rising oil prices. We went to the doctor, in fact, and a diagnosis was made in 1980 in the election and by the newly elected president in January 20th, 1981, when President Reagan took the oath. And that diagnosis is the treatment that we've been under for 30 years. What Ronald Reagan said on that fateful day was, government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. And that was meant as a substantive diagnosis. He said we have inflation, instability, slow growth, rising unemployment, not because we're facing international competition, not because the world economy is changing, not because we have greater scarcity of primary commodities like oil, not because we're getting the first taste of problems of keeping up a global food supply, not because Asia is rising and starting to take on our big three auto industry and all the rest. He said, no, it's none of that. That didn't even enter the scene. It was just taxes are too high and we've regulated too much. And so in 1981, Reagan began a process of dismantling the competency of our government, as well as dismantling the financial base of the government. Now, this is not well understood for maybe a little bit of an esoteric reason, but I have to say a word about
Please.
It. We have four categories of government spending, and it's important to keep them straight. We spend on transfer programs like Social Security and Medicare. They're sometimes called mandatory programs. Those weren't shrunk by Reagan. He tried, but the public said, no way, we like those programs. The second category is the military. And that is obviously, in a budget sense, pretty robust as well. The third category is interest payments on the debt. We have to pay that. That's the obligation of borrowing. Now, the fourth category is the one that I'm talking about. It's all the rest of what government does. We call it, in technical terms, the non-security discretionary budget. Now, that's a piece of jargon which basically says all government goods and services in this economy, other than the military and the transfer programs. So what does it include? It includes all of our infrastructure. It includes our federal highway system. It includes our natural environment. It includes transport beyond the highways, if we ever wanted to have a functioning rail system in this country that was even not decades and decades behind technology, but actually a 21st century system. It includes all of the federal role in education, a role which goes back to the beginning of the Republic and includes great contributions like Abraham Lincoln signing the Land Grant Act, the Morrill Act in 1862 to establish land-grant institutions in the U.S. It includes, of course, the judicial system. It includes public administration, and on and on. This is the part of our government that is disappearing. And it's so poorly understood what's happening in this country and what our politicians are agreeing to and what this budget squeeze really means. We used to spend between 5 and 6 percentage points of national income on that category back in the 1960s and 70s. Reagan came in and immediately slashed that to between 2 and 3 percentage points of GDP. Since the early 80s, we've not invested quantitatively. We have all the programs. We have the headlines. But as a real spending, we've underinvested fundamentally in even keeping our highways up. They're 50 years old and they're dilapidated. In other parts of transport, in the natural environment, in our water and sewerage systems, in our levees, our internal waterways, our dams, all the environmental side. Of course, we haven't even begun even a first step on climate change, because we've been talked into the cheap solution, which is just to deny it. But of course, this is going to be the deadly solution soon enough, and it already is showing up as a deadly solution in many places. This has been going on for almost 30 years, and yet we're in a surrealistic sense that we have greatly overspent on government, and that the most important thing to do is cut spending decisively. And a number that gives me the chills, actually, was agreed between Congress and the White House in August. I don't think I've seen one mention of it in the media, so here's first. And that is that President Obama and Congress agreed, it's in our law, that the budget for the discretionary non-security spending will fall below 2% of gross national product by the end of this decade. We're dismantling the government. And the only difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, or the Republicans are gleeful about it, the Democrats, well, they sign the same thing. And the only difference is they wring their hands about it. They're anguished about it. They give speeches about all the wonderful things our government ought to do. We need to invest. We need to rebuild our infrastructure. We need a new energy system. I love what President Obama says in the first half of every speech. But then the budget reality is that we are on this decline. And he signs up to it, doesn't explain it. And I have recently been in the White House talking to his senior officials. And the answer was, oh, yes, Jeff, we're concerned about that number, too.
What should the media be doing? This is, to me, a serious question. In Boston politics, there used to be an expression about sort of, you know, ward types. Oh, Jeff Sack, he wouldn't tell you your coat was on fire. Who's supposed to tell us that your country's on fire?
I wonder. I think it's two things. One is that I believe that the elite opinion in this country is very confused about the real state of the world and the real state of this country.
Yeah.
Part of it is a kind of confusion that because elite opinion wants to say everything's basically fine. And I feel that we're like at that stage when the curtain has been pulled back from the Wizard of Oz and we have seen how Wall Street behaves and we've seen the criminality, we've seen the illegality, we've seen the stupidity of it.
The impunity of it.
And the impunity, and they keep talking as if the curtain is still closed. But so do a lot of people who swim around that. But the second thing is I wonder, you know, the New York Times for me is very disappointing. It's so cautious. It's so unable to cut through a lot of the nonsense that I wonder whether it's of concern for their advertisers because their advertising keeps going down. I mean, you can't really insult big business in this country without feeling some hit someplace. And I think that this is probably part of the thinking as well. We have turned government over to a few powerful corporate lobbies, and I think people are nervous about it, scared. Mainstream media is owned by them or depends on them for advertising, or maybe it is just socialization at the cocktail parties or whatever it is, but they're not covering this story. And when something like Occupy Wall Street comes up, they're completely befuddled. They don't have an idea. Of course, the Republicans call it a mob, the commies and all of this. That's to be expected, I suppose.
Bill Keller in the New York Times calls them sort of raggedy hippies. Forget them.
Yeah, I think that they don't get it, how unhappy this country is. When I am speaking around the country as I am these weeks, when I say that this isn't a mob, these are our kids and they're onto something very important, the entire auditorium breaks into sustained applause. And that's happened in the Midwest. That's happened in the West Coast. That's happened in the East Coast. People don't view what's happening as mobs. They view it as expressing their anger. And I do feel that this is part of this loss of what I call civic virtue, which is really a sense of responsibility for the well-being of a whole country. And I don't think our elites have it or understand it at this point have the experience and the direct knowledge to know what it means. They just don't experience what most Americans are going through, and they don't seem to really care.
I'm wondering about reform themes as well. I covered George McGovern in 1972. In the late days of that campaign, sort of a lark, but he came up with a slogan, money made by money should be taxed at the same rate as money made by men. Sort of a classic populist economic egalitarian thrust. Of course, he lost the election, but we had a Democratic presidential nominee who could say something like that. Is anybody going to talk about not putting the bad guys in jail, which would be sweet, but fundamentally challenging the premise that money is somehow a sacred occupation, that things are way out of joint and don't feel even American? The idea of hedge funders making billions in a year is somehow profoundly contrary to every neighborhood standard that we grew up in.
If we saw it in another country, we would be aghast. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily recognize it in our own neighborhood quite as clearly as we should.
We barely spoken of the empire, the world out there in which American wars, drone attacks, and otherwise continue and get basically nowhere. But bring the world position into it too, because it seems to me they're related. I was asking Simon Sharma how the burdens that Britain eventually had to lay down in Iraq and in Egypt and Africa around the world became our enemies and our burdens too. And I was wondering, really, does anybody get out front of these collapses and say, no, we've got to retrench, we've got to rethink? And he said, no, these things end in bankruptcy. And they go till they're bankrupt.
Yeah. I keep looking back to our periods of reform in this country. We have a very open society still. And our history has been that we've been able to pull back and rectify things. And I see three great episodes in American history where that's happened. When the Gilded Age became the Progressive Era, from the end of the 19th century to the early years of the 20th century, and we had a Republican president, Teddy Roosevelt, and a Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, who led massive reforms that were prepared by a massive social movement. This was the first time that we pulled back from the huge corruption of our politics during the Gilded Age. I think the second great turn, of course, was when the Harding-Coolidge-Hoover decade of the 1920s, which was, again, a freewheeling, Gordon Gekko, greed is good, mass speculation era, turned into the stock market crash and the onset of the Great Depression, and we were rescued by the New Deal. And by FDR's leadership. And I'm absolutely convinced that FDR was our greatest president in American history. And that set in place decades of prosperity, a much fairer society, capitalism that had a social system to it that created at least increasingly decent lives for an increasing proportion of Americans. I think the 1960s, which again was for me formative in thinking about society and politics and the interaction of the two, was a decisive era for expanding freedom in this country, for the civil rights movement and women's rights and sexual and reproductive rights. And it was a great era. And I think we're ripe for another turn. We've been 30 years in an increasingly decrepit system. They're still channeling Ronald Reagan in the Republican primaries. Thoroughly charming man in certain ways, very funny, told great jokes, had a real presence and did a job on our economy that we're smarting from 30 years later. And I think we're ripe for a change. Now, of course, the timing is all off because that's what Obama was supposed to give us.
Jeffrey Sachs, you begin your new book, The Price of Civilization, saying that you're distressed, if not appalled, to be having to write it.
I decided quite literally, it was a conscious decision, of course, a life decision, that I would work in poorer countries. I would work on the challenges abroad where I thought the needs were greatest. I felt so confident, happy, and secure that this wonderful home base of mine, and of course, I love this country and am grateful for what it enabled me to get in public education and in my training and in my career. But I always felt the base was here, was secure. I had wonderful students at Harvard and at Columbia and a wonderful opportunity for my own family and children. That this country was on its way and it was secure, democracy was secure, and our economy and prosperity was secure, and our fairness as a society would grow over time. We were an adventure, it seemed, in ever-increasing inclusiveness, ever greater more expansive definitions of equality. That was the era that I grew up in with the civil rights movement. Watched my father participate in that as a lawyer in Detroit and believed and cared deeply for it. In other words, I believed that America was just a wonderful place to live, to teach, to raise a family, and that in terms of my skills as an economist, I could apply them elsewhere because they wouldn't really be needed here and they wouldn't really add very much. Of course, for a lot of this period, I've felt increasingly uneasy. It's not just a revelation for me in 2008 that something's seriously wrong. I watched the decline first of international U.S. leadership, probably with more of a front row seat than perhaps almost anybody else in this country. I've seen a lot, but what I've seen over time is this, as I mentioned earlier, this gradual retreat of American will, leadership, morals, guidance in the world, and that's how I first came to this feeling. Not so much about the weakness of the U.S. economy, but watching what was happening abroad, where it was war all the time, but when it came to issues like hunger or poverty or climate or environment or biodiversity, the U.S. was increasingly scarce and finally nowhere to be seen. Then in the last 10 years, the economics, of course, became even more of a sense of worry. So for me, this grew first watching the international retreat from leadership and bemoaning that because I believe we can solve problems. That's my basic view of life, which is that good thinking, good spirit, good ethics, good institutions can solve real problems. We stopped doing that abroad. And then increasingly it became clear we stopped doing that at home. And this book, however, was a chance for me to become much more deeply reacquainted with some of those lapses because I had to fill in for myself a deeper understanding of how these changes had occurred, in which budget cycles, what time, what were the roots, what were the origins, because having worked abroad so much, I had details to fill in on my own. And it did lead me to this sense, as I've explained, that we're watching the working out of a 30-year pattern here. It has been overlaid by short-term drama, by housing bubble, by 9/11, by other events. But this has been a long working out. It's a direction we got started under Reagan and has continued to today. But that's in a way very reassuring in an odd sense, because I come back to Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s theory of the cycles of American history. Mm. And of course, he was the one who drew the public's attention to these waves of private versus public focus from the Gilded Age to the progressives, to Hoover, to the New Deal, and so on. And boy, are we ripe. And in this sense, one can't give up. And one can see in the Occupy Wall Street movement, of course, only the first glimmerings. I wouldn't want to exaggerate what we see, but just the first glimmerings of the next turn of America towards public purpose.
Jeffrey Sachs, in 25 years I've known you, I marvel that you're always a work in progress, always breaking new ground, always thinking about the next path. I hope over the next 25 years I'll get to go with you on one of those house calls around the world. But thank you in the meantime for The Price of Civilization and for this conversation. It's a great pleasure.
Well, Chris, in 25 years, you're the best conversational partner, so anytime.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.